Okay. Welcome to the class. We're going to be looking at Saul today, and we're going to break it down as we typically do in the portions of his life. Look at some of the things he did, and look at some of the verses that are very specific about his behavior and what happened. And then we're going to try to pull it together at the end and give some kind of a diagnosis even, or at least potential diagnoses. And then we'll just sort of see what we can find out about him. We begin by saying that one of the terms used for Saul was that he was the gentle giant. He was, if you remember, he was head and shoulders taller than most of the people of his day. Now, people of his day weren't that terribly tall, but he was taller than anybody else. He would be, in today's world, he would be a seven-footer. Because you'd recognize a seven-footer walking into the room very easily. You would recognize Saul walking into the room. He was a son of Kish. His daddy was, so the Bible says, 1 Samuel chapter 9, we run into some of this kind of stuff, was a wealthy man. Now, wealth in that day and time didn't mean money. It tended to mean animals. See, he had lots of herds, and he had lots of sheep, cattle, all that good kind of stuff. But he was a privileged son of a fairly wealthy person of his day and time. Okay? He was also, quote, a head taller than any of the others. You will also find that in his early life, that's why we call him the first phase of Saul's life, he's sometimes called the gentle giant. He then has other things that come after that. But during the gentle phase, we read things like he was very considerate. Remember, his dad sent him out to find some sheep, flocks that had been lost and didn't know where they were. And then at one point he says, we need to go back home because, quote, my father will start worrying more about us than he worries about his flocks. Well, he was a considerate young man. He thought about his parents, his dad in particular. He was aware of his place and his people. He was from, in the United States terminology, he'd sort of be a good Mississippi boy, in the sense that he was from the smallest tribe, and he was also from one of the smallest families in the smallest tribe. So he was a Benjaminite. So he was aware of that. So he was aware of his place and his people. Chapter 10, verse 9. It's where we come across this little phrase that's used. God worked in his heart. Now, normally speaking, we think if God works in somebody's heart, well, you know, they must be a believer. And for all I know, he was. But we'll look at more about that in a minute. You'll find that in, again, chapter 10, verse 9. He also, shortly after that, is talked about as prophesying. So he became a prophet. Well, he's getting his credentials all lined up here to be one of the good guys. He was also a fairly humble guy because he has been told that he is going to be the future king of Israel. And yet when his uncle says, where you been? What's been going on, boy? He says, well, we went out and we're looking for the sheep and everything else. He never mentions that he's been told he's going to be the king of Israel. By the way, if a prophet, God came and spoke to me and said, you're going to be the president of the United States, I'd whisper it to somebody. I might not stand on the corner and shout and claim, but I'd say, hey, this guy told me I'm going to be the president. None of that. He's quiet. He's gentle. All right, he doesn't tell his uncle about what's about to happen. Remember when it comes time to select a king? Now, if I'm head and shoulders taller than everybody, and I've been told by Samuel that I'm going to be the next king of the whole deal, and I've got everything, I'm prophesying, I've got everything going, and God's changed my heart, and it's about time to select a king, don't you think I'd stand up and say, well, hey, y'all, here I am. He doesn't do that. He goes and hides in the baggage. He doesn't wish to be king. He is a humble guy. He hides in the baggage. Well, they mention again how tall he is, so he had trouble hiding even in the baggage. So, when some despised him and didn't want him to be the king, once you have been made to be king, what kings typically did in that day and time was, you got rid of the opposition. If somebody didn't like me, bye. And yet, when these groups of people did not wish him to be king, the Bible says he kept silent. Chapter 10, verse 27, I think it is. So he kept silent. We're painting a picture here of a gentle giant, a good guy. He also was a fairly decent military leader. He organized the people. He raised 30,000 from Judah, 300,000 from Israel to fight. So he rallies the people. He sets up the divisions. He's doing all the good stuff. He's being a very effective king. And when they have this battle, chapter 11, verse 13, he gives God the credit for what has happened. He says, "The Lord has rescued Israel." Oh, he's doing it all right. He was then reaffirmed as king, chapter 11, verse 14, 15. Now, the best judgment that we have, there's a passage in here where it's talked about how old he was and what he did and everything, but that passage is a little bit disputed. But the best understanding is he was around 30 years old when he became king of Israel. And he reigned for 40 years. He was approximately 72 years old when he died. I'm 73. He died at my age after having been king for 42 years. Okay, so far, everything's cool. If we could stop our story right there, there'd be no question about anything. But we have to chug along here. He also was a very impulsive person, or as he became king and ruled as king, he became more and more impulsive in what he did. He didn't always think things through. Once, you know, the old adage that we have, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Well, he is a good illustration, if you want to make the point, of that being true. For instance, well, chapter 13, 1 Samuel. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. He chose 3,000 men, 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country, Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan and Gilba and Benjamin. And then it says, Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear that there's been an attack here." So all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost. Wait a minute. I thought his son Jonathan did that. He claimed credit for what his son had done. Now granted, the leader takes credit for what those under him do. But it's almost as if suddenly there's been a little bit of a change here. This is not the quiet, easygoing guy who didn't want to claim anything for himself. Suddenly, he's wanting credit for what's going on here. So, he wants credit for having attacked the Philistines. And this is that passage where Israel has become a stench to the Philistines. Okay, now, he's also had called Samuel to come make a sacrifice before battle. Samuel didn't exactly jump when Saul said froggy, but he told him he'd be there in a week. Well, he waited, talking about Saul, he waited. And by the way, there was an overwhelming force of Philistines that were coming up against him. I mean, like, they were outnumbered 10-1. And not only that, but with every passing day, people were deserting his army. So his forces were going away rapidly. So he had Samuel's supposed to come. We're not going to go into battle without a sacrifice. So Saul comes up with an answer to that. I'll just do the sacrifice myself. Now, I can't tell you what went through his head, but after all, he's prophesied. You know, he's done all the stuff, and he's honored God. So he just does the sacrifice. And then when Samuel comes, as soon as the sacrifice is over, he says, "You have acted foolishly." Chapter 13, verse 13. So he's told he's acted foolishly. Ah. He was bound, by the way, to 600 men at that point. As a matter of fact, on the day of the battle, this is from chapter 13. On the day of the battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or spear in his hand. Only Saul and Jonathan had them. They had plowshares, they had a scythe, they had stuff, but no sword or spears. So this was a ragtag army. Obviously, they didn't have the ability to outfit the army, but they didn't have swords or spears. And he's got this massive Philistine coming, so he does what an awful lot of people do. My opinion, he panicked. So he goes on and says, "Okay, I'm going to do this sacrifice thing so God will be on our side so we'll win, because if I don't, we're going to have anybody to fight. We've got to do it now, and Samuel's not here, so let's go, guys." You can just feel that almost as you read the passage here. Now, then we have the case where Jonathan attacked, he and his armor bearer, and they killed 20, and et cetera, et cetera. A battle's coming on. Well, Samuel makes a vow as he's dealing with Saul. He tries to get him to shape up. But Saul also makes a vow. And his vow that you've heard about. His vow is, not a man in the army is to eat or drink until our enemies are killed. He makes that promise. And then a few verses later, he says something else. "I don't care, even if it's my son Jonathan, if he eats before this battle, this killing of the enemy is done, he is to be killed." Where is this coming from? It's obvious to me, he's trying to be so emphatic to inspire his troops so that we're not going to do anything. And if my boy does it, I'll kill my son if he does this wrong thing. Oh. Chapter 14, verse 24. "No one is to eat until I have avenged myself on my enemies." He repeats it on verse 39. "Even if it lies with my son Jonathan, he must not eat." Ah, but we have a problem here. During the battle, while this is going on, it hadn't finished, Jonathan comes across a beehive. It's got honey in it. And he eats. Now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I avenge myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. But then Jonathan does. Well, he's got an impulsive streak going in him, even to the point of threatening to... By the way, the men wouldn't let him kill Jonathan. So they said, no, you're not going to do that. Now we come to him as he's the impulsive king, the gentle giant, the impulsive king. And now we have the disobedient king. Samuel tells Saul to attack the Amalekites and kill everybody. It gets real specific. If you read the Old Testament, in our world of today, we value human life so. We value the individual so. We don't have a sense of corporate responsibility. Now, the closest we come to that is family responsibility. But, you know, we don't have this corporate sense of responsibility. Back then, corporate responsibility was a big thing. So when he is told to kill all men, women, and children, infants, cattle, sheep, camels, and donkeys. Chapter 15, verse 3. He's told to do all this. Okay, he does. He hears, but he doesn't do it. And they win the battle. They spare Agag, the king. Now, the reason you spare the king is very simple. You ransom the dude. You're going to get money out of him. But not only did he spare Agag, he also spared the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves, the lambs, and everything that was good. Chapter 15, verse 9. So he doesn't do what he's supposed to do. Now when Samuel comes, he confronts him with his lack of obedience. He says, but I did obey the Lord. Now, in his mind, this is my statement, not his. Success does not equal obedience. The fact that you're successful does not necessarily mean you're obeying the Lord. Sometimes when you obey the Lord, you don't have worldly success. But in this particular case, he said, I've been blessed. I did. Look what's happened here. But it's not so. Success does not equal obedience. And then he gets honest. He's confronted again. So finally, Saul fesses up. He says, okay, I was afraid of the people, and so I gave in to them. Chapter 15, verse 24. He's confronted. He's going to be embarrassed. He's going to be humiliated. But then he says, please, in verse 30, honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Don't embarrass me in front of the leaders of Israel. You see the difference between the gentle giant? You see the impulsive part of the king. But now you see, I want to be thought well of. Now this was a guy who didn't want to be king. There's been a change. Something's happened. Something's gone on here. Still, he wanted the approval. Now we come to the tormented king. Chapter 16. The Spirit of the Lord departed Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. Chapter 16, verse 14. Remember, this is where David played the harp, and the music of the harp would soothe him when he was in a troubled, whatever it was going on with him. So he had this troubled thing that would happen to him. David played the harp. Now, side trip. This would be soothing to Saul. It would calm him down. And we have, in terms of the layout of 1 Samuel, the sequence is not, we don't think the sequence is all chronological. But the degree to which we can, we have to point out some inconsistencies here in terms of chronology. Chapter 16, verse 23, David would play the harp and soothe Saul. And then the Goliath story comes in chapter 17, David and Goliath. And then in chapter 17:55, Saul says to Abner, his commander-in-chief, whose son is that young man, David? Whose son is he? And this is after he killed Goliath. You'd think he'd remember that, wouldn't you? Well, maybe something was going on with him that he didn't remember. Okay? He's head and taller than anybody. Anybody that should have fought Goliath, it should have been Saul. He was the biggest guy doing it. And he didn't. As a matter of fact, the kid did. David was probably a teenager. Could have been as young as 16 when he fought Goliath. The sling killed him, the whole deal. Anyway, Saul then becomes very jealous of David. Remember, the people sang their song. Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Ooh, you know, I've got this kid now coming on who's going to take over everything. Now, there are so many stories in there. We don't have time to go into all this. David wanted to marry one of Saul's daughters. Remember, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll let you marry my daughter. Let's go ahead and say it the way it is. Bring me 100 foreskins from Philistines. Kill 100 guys, cut off the ding-dong, and bring it to me. That's what he says. Well, David brings him 200. He did a big major circumcision week. But he brought literally the foreskins in order to marry his daughter. Surprise all, he thought he was going to get rid of David because there's no way he'd kill that many. He'd get killed trying to kill him, and so that's a good way to get rid of him. But it didn't work. He's become devious. He doesn't read. He doesn't do the stuff that he's supposed to do. As a matter of fact, Saul gets into a major conflict with Jonathan, his son. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, verse 30 of chapter 20. And he said to him, And I'm sorry, ladies, but this is the way guys think, okay? When your son messes up, whose fault is it? Obviously, it's the wife's. It's mama's fault. Had she not messed him up, he would have been all right. See, if he just, you know, if you give him to me, I'll shape that dude up, right? Okay, same thing here. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan. He said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." What does that have to do with anything? Other than me having an excuse because my son isn't doing right. "Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you?" Now, wait a minute. Anyway, he's mixing all this up. "As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." He's gotten to the point now he has to get rid of David because David is a threat to his heirs, to his establishment of his kingdom. Suddenly your legacy becomes very important. Now this is the gentle giant. This is the impulsive guy. But now he's wanting a legacy. He wants everybody to rent the house of Saul. Needs to be established. And Jonathan, you're messing it up. So he wants to keep the power in the family. So he tried to kill David. Remember, he throws his spear at David a couple of times. He throws his spear at Jonathan, his son. He gets very angry. And in his anger, he behaves in a very irrational way. He has problems here. There's also a question about his eyesight, by the way, just for the side issue. On a couple of occasions, David will speak to him. And he can see David. But if you look at chapter 24, verse 16, he says, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" He hears the voice and it sounds like David, but he can't look at him and tell that it is. Saul recognizes the voice. Chapter 26, verse 17, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" Again, when David comes around. So the question is, does he have good eyesight? But we also know that on one occasion he would not eat. Chapter 28, verse 20, "His strength was gone, for he had eaten nothing at all that day and night." 28, verse 20. And he refused and says, "I will not eat." He went through periods of time when he refused to eat. So suddenly we're beginning to get some symptomatology here, okay? And then finally, and we'll be through with this part of everything, we do know that he committed suicide. He's in a battle. His sons have been killed. Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, his third son, all three were killed in this battle. And so they're about to kill him. He's wounded by the archers. So he's got arrows stuck in him. He tells his armor bearer to, you know, "Kill me. Don't let those uncircumcised fellows come and run me through." Well, the armor bearer won't do it, so he falls on his sword. He couldn't stand the thought of the embarrassment of what they would do to him and to his body. And he was probably right, you know, that they would do that kind of thing. So his fear was legitimate. Now, let's think about some things here just a minute. He was a powerful soldier, but sometimes after the age of 30, he began to have, shall we say, some emotional problems. He would make rash statements. He would be impulsive in what he was doing. He would act out to the point of trying to throw a spear at his own son. He didn't think things through. His impulsivity became overwhelming. And then sometimes he would take to his bed. And he would not rest, or he would stay up and not go to bed. He had, shall we say, a term that was not used back then, mood swings. Could we use that term for Saul? Yeah, I think so. Now, I read this to you before with another person, but this is from the DSM-5. This one I'm continuing to use, although they got a new one out, but I'm using this one because I'm going to give you some of the criteria to be used here. Major depressive syndrome. Depressed mood. Well, he had that. Diminished interest or pleasure in all or most all the activities of the day. Well, he had some of that. Weight loss or weight gain, or decrease or increase in appetite. Well, he had the appetite, refused to eat. Insomnia or hypersomnia. Well, psychomotor agitation or retardation. Well, we could make a case for that too. Fatigue or loss of energy. Feelings of worthlessness or excessive inappropriate guilt. Well, he felt guilty. Don't know that he had that one. Diminished ability to think or concentrate or indecisiveness. Well, he had some of that. Recurrent thoughts of death or suicidal ideation. Well, he ended up with some of that. He didn't have it all the time. Maybe he had some depression going on. Sounds like he might have, doesn't it? Well, it does to me. But we have to shift over. Maybe he was bipolar. Now, everybody's heard that term. Everybody talks about that in today's world. You know, that's an explanation for anybody who doesn't fit in very well. Now, I'm being sarcastic, okay? I'm being a little facetious, so indulge me for that. Manic episode. A distinct period of abnormality and persistent, elevated, expansive, or irritable mood. Well, he had that for sure. He was irritated a lot with people he loved and cared about. During this period of mood disturbance, at least three of the following. Inflated self-esteem or grandiosity. I want my house to be established. It doesn't matter what God wants. I want it. Don't you understand, Jonathan? Decreased need for sleep. More talkative than usual. Flight of ideas or subjective experience of thoughts that are racing. Distractibility. Increase in goal-directed activity, either so excessive involvement in pleasurable activities which have a higher or potential or painful consequence. Pleasurable, he wanted to be king. Well, anyway, you can play with that one. Mood disturbance. Yep, he would had that. At no time during the disturbance has been delusions or hallucinations. At no time during the disturbance have there been delusions or hallucinations. He doesn't appear to have been delusional or have hallucinations or think things there that aren't there kind of thing. Okay, not schizophrenic. Well, I submit to you that I think he was bipolar. No way to prove it. I can't lay it out there. But I think he suffered from an evil spirit. Now we come into some real interesting areas as Christians. If God removes his spirit from a person, do they in fact then become susceptible to mental illness? That's an interesting thought. He had depressed mood, impaired judgment, paranoia he had also, sleep disturbance, appetite variation, and he had a cyclical pattern. He would say, David, my son, and then he'd try to kill him. Say, David, my son, and then he'd try to kill him. So he had the cycle going. So, I'll just go ahead and say, manic depressive disorder, bipolar, with paranoid features. Now, do anybody in here know anybody that has been diagnosed as bipolar? I do. Okay? Yeah. It went on back then. Now, whether I'm right or wrong is not the major issue right now, okay? So my diagnosis is not the critical fact I'm talking about. But the fact is critical that back then they had emotional disorders, whether I'm right or not. He had something going on, y'all. He had something. The question is, though, and this is where the real rub comes, was he a born-again Christian? Is he going to be in heaven? God had his hand upon him. God changed his heart. He was a different person. He prophesied. He then apparently went into some kind of a psychiatric disorder. Did that remove him from his relationship with God? This is why there's a controversy over Saul. And that's why I chose to use him today. We don't really know. Again, I'll repeat. Derek Thomas says he does not believe Saul was, quote, a believer, unquote. Now, we have those who are cultural Christians today. If you have been reared going to church every Sunday, and that's just the way it is, but you never make a commitment to the Lord. Could it be that Saul was reared as an Israelite, as one who just believed culturally, socially? That's a possibility. Is it a possibility that he is in heaven in spite of all that he did because God's hand was upon him, and even though the evil spirit came upon him, God didn't give up on him? That's a possibility. But it raises the question. From this is where we get the kind of discussion that preachers talk about, okay? Try to debate whether or not, you know, somebody is. Man looks on the outward appearance, God looks on the heart. We can't make decisions about someone's salvation. But I present it to you as a case in point, in my opinion, of someone who had a major psychiatric disorder, whatever it was. Could it have been a major depression? Could it have been a paranoid, with paranoia all in it? I think it's bipolar. But I don't know about his heart. But what I encourage us to do, especially dealing with our kids, let's love them, let's care for them, but let's push to make sure it's not a cultural thing only that they're caught up in. Which is why we put them through a program here, a catechism class, a confirmation class. We want them to know what's going on. We want them to be able to talk about, articulate. We don't want them to assume that because then we want them to make a choice. Now,